Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, authors Jocelyn Nicole Johnson and Rebecca Mackay discuss their work in Johnson's acclaimed collection, My Monticello. The following conversation originally took place at the American Writers Festival on May 15, 2022, and was recorded live.
In My Monticello, Jocelyn Nicole Johnson reckons with the legacy of slavery in stories that range from the tale of descendants of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings on the run from a white militia to a university professor studying racism by conducting a secret social experiment on his own son. The book, Johnson's debut, was a New York Times notable book of 2021 and is being adapted for Netflix by Cherman Entertainment. Johnson lives and writes in Charlottesville, Virginia. She has also been a fellow at Hedgebrook, Tin House Summer Workshops, and VCCA. In 2018, her short story, Control Negro, was anthologized in Best American Short Stories, guest edited by Roxane Gay, and read live by LeVar Burton as a part of PRI's Selected Shorts series. She's here today in conversation with Rebecca Mackay, author of the novels The Great Believers, The 100-Year House, and The Borrower, as well as the short story collection, Music for Wartime. Please put your hands together to welcome them on stage.
Hi. So first of all, thank you all for finding this room, this gorgeous room, and making your way in here. And please, if you're lingering in the hall, please feel free to come inside, unless you're just here to take pictures. That's cool, too. So Jocelyn, welcome to Chicago.
Thank you so much.
And it's your first time in Chicago, which is very exciting, because this is what every interior in Chicago looks like. I just want to make sure you're clear on that. Even like our McDonald's, they're all... So I want to say a little bit by way of introduction for how I found this book, which is that, like many people, I started hearing a lot of buzz about this book last year. There was an incredible feature about you in the Times. There was just seemed like everyone was talking about it. And so I figured I had to read it. And I did actually listen on audio the first time I read it, which was amazing. And I'm like, God, this is incredible, this debut. I wish I knew this woman. And then the next day, I log on to Facebook, and it goes, you have memories today with whatever, and Jocelyn Johnson. I'm like, I do? I know her already. but it turns out that we had met probably 10 years ago when I came to Charlottesville to do something with a group that you were involved with and became Facebook friends. And then I was like, oh my God, I already know her. This is amazing. So when they asked me at the Writers Museum who I'd like to bring to Chicago to interview, and this was my choice. So
I'm really glad she did.
So I wonder, just first of all, because I'm always assuming that there are some people in the audience who know a book and some people who don't. So I'm wondering if you can kind of give us just your own version of what this book is, what, you know, what it covers.
That should be such an easy question because I've answered it many times launching the book, but it kind of comes last, right? So when you're making something, often the meaning of it or what it is after it's really close to the end, you're thinking, how do I encapsulate this? What am I trying to put into this book? But essentially, it's a book of five short stories and a novella that the origin of it was this idea of myself as a native Virginian, as someone who was born in the United States, but was born and raised in Virginia. But my family, my parents and my older brother were all born in South Carolina. So there's this way in which I'm like a first generation Virginian. And so I think the book in one way is about how Virginia is unequivocally my home, and there's these ways in which it feels alien to me, or sometimes I feel excluded from it because of my identity as the person I am, as a Black woman, as the nerdy person that I am, and just, you know, just as my art teacher self. And so in August 12th, 2017, I was living in Charlottesville teaching public school. I had been writing for many years, and we were the unwitting host to Ignite the Right rally, which was kind of a precursor to the storming of the Capitol, where men in polo shirts with torches came and said, you will not replace us, into the ovens, and this kind of rhetoric. And a woman was killed, Heather Heyer, and it was a big to-do in our town. And so one of the stories is directly about that, but all of the stories in here, the ones that preceded that and the ones that were written, you know, right after that, are all about this idea of home. So there's these stories about what is home, who belongs, what is it like to be on the inside and outside of belonging, and what do we owe one another? What does freedom look like, depending on who you are? And so those are some of the things I was thinking about in the collection.
Yeah, I almost called it a novel. It feels like that in some ways, because it's so, everything's so tightly wound together. But it's a collection that is very much not only about place, but about who owns a place, who has the rights to a place. And the novella, which is called My Monticello, I mean, this is basically taking that 2017 event and kind of asking what if it had been a little bit more apocalyptic. And then these people, from a largely black neighborhood, going and taking over Monticello as kind of, in one case, this woman has a claim to it as an ancestral home, but also going, you know, this is our fortress. We're reclaiming this. This is ours now. That, I think that's what, for me, that was the hook that I first heard about this book. That was the thing everyone was talking about. It's certainly, you know, with the, you know, the cover of the book, the title of the book, that novella seems like the linchpin of the whole thing, right?
So absolutely. So I wrote the novella last. It was the last thing I wrote, but it pulled together all the strands from the other stories. And the way that I came to it was, and as I said, in August 12, 2017, this thing happened. I was still teaching public school. I had to go into students the next week, and you know, they had all experienced this thing too. And I thought, how do you react to this thing? And I ended up reacting by writing this novella. And it came about a year later when I went to an event. It was kind of the year anniversary of this deadly event, this uprising of white supremacy in our community and in our nation. And I went to an event where a descendant of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson was introduced at the end of the event, this woman who stood up, this black woman. And then I literally saw her pumping gas like the next week, and I was like, that's that woman. And there was something about just the embodiment of someone, right? So it wasn't just the idea of something, but just to think that, you know, we're all descendants of something. And somehow that's what connected this very specific present moment of reckoning with the past. Because where I live in Charlottesville, Virginia, Thomas Jefferson's kind of this, you know, his like effigy, like the silhouette of him is kind of all over town. And the University of Virginia is there, his premier university. Monticello sits on a hill about a 10-minute drive from my home. And so it's kind of, he's kind of omnipresent. And then to rethink about it in terms of, you know, going to Monticello as a tourist when I first moved to Charlottesville, where slavery was kind of unspeakable, and it's changed over that 20-some years. But just thinking about who should feel comfortable there. So I kind of wanted to center a descendant of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings in this case, because it connected this idea of, I don't know, my own ambivalence as a black American going to a place that I know is a former plantation, but then hearing about the greatness of a founding father to the exclusion of some of the other stories that are there. But then also, who would own that place more than someone who's a descendant of both that founding father and an enslaved person whose effort, work, and care enriched that person and allowed them to do the things they wanted to do. So it just seemed like such a central irony of our country. And so when I wrote it, America wasn't where we are now, right? I was writing it kind of like, if August 12th continued, what would the world look like? And unfortunately, we're further into that space than when I wrote the book. I wasn't anticipating it to be this way. And so I really was thinking about what would it look like if this continued along with the care or lack of care we have for the environment, along with the care or lack of care we have for our shared infrastructure. What would it look like if things broke down and these kind of men were raiding and taking space, and what if a group of my neighbors, the community I center is literally like the street, first street is like one street over from me where I walk my dogs and where like I used to push my kid in the stroller and so forth. And so I thought, what would it look like if someone had to flee here who was a descendant and ended up in Monticello and ended up occupying that space, the museum of the house as it would be in this time of unraveling, and ended up claiming it and being there. So that was kind of the central idea of the novella.
It's amazing. So the novella is an unusual form, maybe, for this day and age, and it's a tricky form. I am going to ask the obnoxious novella question, which is, you know, why that length? You know, I'm sure that people have asked you, why not make that a whole novel? And it sounds like you were writing, you know, you were completing a story collection. And then the other question is, you know, was it a story that grew to this length? Did you want it to? I think it's the perfect length. I think that this form, this kind of stories leading up to this like masterpiece finale, where you really, it's almost like appetizers and then a main course, I would say. You really, you know, you have something to really sink your teeth into. But people don't understand what the novella is often, and it's tricky. And I wonder if you got pressure to turn it into a novel in the publishing world, if you ever wanted it to be a different length, or were you like, yes, it's a novella and it's going to be a novella?
I was a public school art teacher. I didn't have this idea of, you know, I really was going on gut level. I am a short story writer, I think, in part just the practical reality of being a public school art teacher, right? So I had to write things in the summer around, you know, the space that I had, the kind of capacity I had to write really fits short stories. Plus, it's something I like. I love compression. I love leave them wanting more. Even there's these beautiful long novels I want to read, but I'm like, I can't read all that at once. You know, like I want to be in like 10 people's brain at once, so I'd rather read like 10 short things that someone wrote sometimes. But I do recognize that the novel's kind of the gold standard for our culture, like how we think of it, especially as a debut. I've been told, someone I shopped out this to said, you should write two novels first, and then we'll try to publish this collection. And I thought, this isn't the partner for me, right? So when I wrote the novella, it was a short story, actually, at first. It was shorter. It had kind of the same idea, the same beginning, a very similar ending, and a much less scaffolding in the middle. And then as I was working, I realized this needs more. It needs more of the transition in between. And so I really just kept making it until it felt complete to my own feeling of satisfaction and taste. And so it is kind of, it isn't just a novella in length, it's also a novella in style. There's something about the ending that has a short story feel. There's something about the way it's painted, the sense of compression. And I thought that suited the story because it's a story that, is 19 days. It's very, there's a lot that happens, but it's also told from the point of view of this character who's kind of in a very panic sense relaying this information to us. So it seemed to fit. And then I happened to have found a partner and my literary agent who loves short stories. Like I was like, she was the person for me because she had published this other short story collection I love called Friday Black by Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya.
It's a brilliant collection.
And several other short story writers she was super excited about. And so I think because I published at 50 for the first time, and that was the third project I'd put out with my third agent, I recognized that there was no guarantee that it would be published. And so I thought, well, I'm going to make what I want to make. If that's the case, if there's no guarantee, I would rather make something I'm interested in. If it's published by an indie publisher, wonderful. If it's not published, that could, well, I won't be behind the game because I literally have done that twice before. And I happened to find publishers who were excited about publishing it all together. I did talk to some people who were like, we would love to just do the novel or the novella, a standalone piece. In the UK, it's published as a standalone, just the novella. And in the translations it's been picked up for, it's been standalone.
Wow.
Which
okay.
is interesting. Huh. So it can stand alone, but it still has that novella feel. I like it because the story collection used to be called Virginia's Not Your Home, which is the second story in the collection.
Yeah.
And I think that's like the call and response. Virginia's Not Your Home versus My Monticello. It's like the claiming of it. It's like the answer to the question. And I think that there's callbacks between the stories. Like the line, Virginia, it's not your home, is a line in the novella. There's these ways in which the stories point to one another. I think there's something so beautiful about a collection. Even if it's not what people generally read, it can be interesting to try it. And I've been really pleased that people have been willing to that might not be short story readers.
Yeah. One of the joys of a collection like this, especially when it's someone's debut and the world is just getting to know their voice, is we can see the full range of what that author is doing, or at least a range. I'm sure there's more beyond that. And one thing, looking back through this collection, one thing that struck me was that you're using an entirely different type of point of view in every story. So the first story is kind of first person, but also second person talking to this guy talking to his son. You have sort of a second person directed at the self. You have a checklist. You have a first person plural. You have a straight on third person story. And then the novella itself is kind of traditional first person. And there's no repeats. You know, I started flipping through and I was like, well, does she have any that are the same? They're all a different point of view. So I want to know, is that something, you know, was that a matter of choice as you selected among the stories that you'd written what would go in the book? Are you challenging yourself as you complete what you perceive as a collection in your head to hit those different notes? Is it a happy accident? What happened?
I really do just, I'm pulled to different voices. I often, even when I'm writing like an email or something from my own point of view, I often leave off the I. Like I'm like going to the da-da-da. And there's this way in which I think just, you know, I think we have an internal ear, like the way that we hear things and the way we tend to write. And I do tend to write the you and the second person, some things that are a little bit less common in storytelling come really easily to me, so I think I can slip into them. But I just like all the things. You know, there's a story in the collection, The King of Xandria, that's like a third person close over the shoulder. And I always love that point of view because the character isn't someone that embodies my lived experience. He's a Nigerian father who's immigrated here. But I can still totally see him, you know, because there's a way the story takes place within a school and I'm a public school teacher. I was a public school teacher for 20 years. An art teacher. And so I know what it feels like to see a parent and notice all these things about them and imagine them, right? That's a certain kind of knowing. Whereas the story, Virginia's Not Your Home, the you is much closer to me and I could have access to the internalness. So really it's just, I go all over the place. I write all over the place. That comes naturally to me. And then when I selected stories, I just selected the ones I liked the best. And then the only time we really thought about like the point of view was arranging them, right? So wanting it to have the variety where one story leads into another and so it kind of bounces around so that you have this wee voice of school children in one story and you have the letter from the father to son in the first opening story, Control Negro. It just to make it make sense and to have the reader have a sense of variety and, you know, the chorus just for it to work.
So you've mentioned a couple times being a teacher, and I taught Montessori Elementary School for my 20s and 30s, and was writing, and most of what I was writing was short stories, because that's, you know, you'd think like, oh, you have the summer, but it's, you know, you're kind of exhausted, and you're doing everything else, and it's somewhere in there I wrote my first novel, but that balance between working with really creative young people, but you're also kind of like, you know, bleeding out for them, like, you know, you're giving them everything. And then fostering your own creativity, carving out time for yourself. It sounds like you're not teaching anymore, is that right? Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what that balance was like for you, you know, identifying yourself as a writer, but having this other career, which I think is the way most, you know, obviously, the way most writers start. Most writers don't just graduate from college and then go get hired as a novelist somehow. You know, you have this other career, and then, you know, how do you not lose your identity in that career when you know that fundamentally you have this other thing going on? I want to hear what that was like for you, and you know, how long were you writing? Were you writing that whole time?
So, yeah, that's a really good question. Just how did that balance go from being a public school art teacher, writing. I just, at some point, I think I loved writing since childhood. And I just always found a place for it, but I'm super practical minded. Like my parents basically moved from South Carolina to Virginia for economic reasons, right? They had kind of hit the ceiling of what they could do there. They were both teachers, and that was kind of it. And so I think the model they had for me was like, you need to get an actual job that exists, right? And you have to be able to care for yourself and move up in that. And my husband always laughs because our friends were all these bohemian artists. And he was like, you actually had a job. Like, I started teaching public school right out of college. And he was like, I'm going to tie my sail to that one. She's got it together. And so I think teaching, the nice thing is you do have a little bit of space. And I was fortunate enough not to have to work in the summers. And I kind of very early on, in fact, there's someone here I did a workshop with many, many years ago, started to do workshops in the summer or do something like kind of carve out a creative time before I had a child where I could go and really think about creative things. And I just kind of kept up that habit. And I think it was just necessity. It seems impossible to me now that I was able to continue writing, but because teaching is so consuming. But there is something that feeds you about whatever else you're doing. In a way, now that I'm just sitting in my house, especially with the pandemic and being closed in, it's harder to access, like just coming here to the city and seeing something different and feeling a different pulse of how things work and being beside a different building and having to figure out how to use all the apps on my phone that I never have to use, right? There's a challenge in that immediately story starts to come to me, yeah. Just from being in these agitating experiences. And public school teaching will definitely put you in agitating experiences. I mean, I loved it. I really, really, like, absolutely loved being a public school art teacher for little kids. Like, I had a chime that I would, and everyone would breathe, and we had like a whole thing. And you know, it was a really lovely job, but it was extremely challenging. And so, but it gave me a lot of information because I constantly was seeing a parent or seeing someone be kind or seeing someone be not kind or seeing the ways in which that system worked for people or seeing the ways it was failing people. And so there's all that would create story for me. So I think it both made it difficult and also was kind of wonderful.
Yeah. I think I had a similar experience. And I think for me, you know, teaching Montessori, like teaching art, was like, you're listening to the kids more than you're standing up there, you know, kind of on tape recorder mode. Like, you're really, and the kids are weird. Kids are really weird. And you have, I'm blinking on the title, which is why I'm leafing through here, but your wonderful story about school children, tell me the name, sorry.
Something Sweet on Our Tongues.
Yes. You do just this phenomenal job of writing children in that story. And I have a whole set of pet peeves when people write children, because I worked with children for so long and different ages, and I have so many pet peeves about the ways people get things wrong. Just like, don't even bother researching what would a kid know at this age or what would they be like. They just kind of, I think I remember what it was like to be seven. No, you don't. And you do it just dead on with their kind of their brutality as well as their empathy, as well as just developmentally, you know, who they'd be. I would love if you, you know, do you feel like you drew in that story on your experience of teaching? Do you feel like you drew more on your own memories of childhood?
I have to say first that I have that peeve in commercials and in TV when they have a kid drawing on the fridge, and I'm like, I can tell immediately if it's a real child drawing or if it's not, like the fake child drawing.
Oh my God.
You know what I mean?
Yes, totally. It's like the happy son, and it's like, no, kids are weirder than that, sorry.
I definitely, that story, don't tell my students or school system, but I had a year, this really difficult year, and I just was constantly like, crafting that story in my brain, and none of the particulars of the story are any one kid or anything, but it was like the energy of like kid rebellion, you know, like,
yeah.
Which I both was terrifying because I was supposed to be the person who was corralling this group of children together, but it was also, I like slightly admired, it was like they were staging a coup in the school this one year, and it wasn't just in my class, it was like a school-wide coup. But yeah, I really came at that from being a teacher. And one thing I really often do is take the point of view in these stories of the person who I feel less, that isn't me as much. You know, in the first story, it's about a father who's kind of testing racism in a kind of this brutal way, which I would not recommend to anyone, which is he's basically using his son as a scientific control to compare against white a white man his same age to see if his child is perfect enough, if he presents himself a certain way, can he too have access to America's promise, right? And so I'm taking the view of this person who has a point of view I don't think is a safe one for his child, right? And in that story, I'm with the kids. Like, I'm like, a lot of times I'm writing to figure out why something is the way it is. Same, you know, why is this way, or what can we do about it? It's like, instead of writing to show what I know to the reader, I'm writing to reveal what I don't know to myself and to figure out what I do know about it, or get at the edges of it, or come around and think about it in a certain way. Yeah. And in that, I was like, what do I know about these kids? So it was a lot of observation, but also, what can I imagine if I put myself squarely in their point of view?
Yeah. It's funny. I wonder if you, there's this very specific kind of nightmare when you're a teacher. You have these teaching nightmares where the kids just have a revolution or something like that. And of course, that's not from a teacher's point of view, but it very much tapped into like teaching nightmares that I still have more than a decade after I stopped teaching that age.
Be nice to public school teachers. It's a really hard job.
No kidding. Yeah. Right. No kidding. I want to talk to you about having a debut book out. You know, it came out last year, which is maybe a strange time to have a book come out. Maybe not as strange as 2020, where people with debuts out especially were just kind of lost, I think. But it must have been a little bit of a strange time to have a debut out. In addition to which, publishing a book is just a bizarre experience to begin with. You know, you've realized so many of your dreams, but then it's also this, like, you have to put on a show for people, and also you get reviewed, and that's weird. So I'm curious, you know, this book did so well. It's been long listed for a bunch of awards. It's been, you know, it got that New York Times notable book. They only pick 100 books published that year of all genres to be a New York Times notable book. That's a huge accomplishment for a debut novel. I'm wondering, has this been mostly harrowing, mostly joyful? Has it been bizarre? Has it been what you expected to have a book out in the world?
I'm so thankful, like even just looking out here, like that if you make something, like as a visual art person and as a writer, and anyone cares about it at all, you are like, it's amazing, yeah. Truly. And so, as I said, I had been writing for a really long time since I was a teenager, and writing really seriously for a good 20 years, where I had agents and people who thought, oh, this is good, you have something interesting to say, and having books sent out and almost getting published and not, you know, and just, so I'd had a lot of experiences, and I'm so grateful that I had those experiences, because I think it made me not take for granted a moment of having this book, feeling it come together, feeling like it was something that I'd be proud to have be my first debut, that was saying something about the world that I cared deeply about, worried about. And then knowing myself and being a grown 50-year-old person who thought, I know what's important about this and I know what isn't. In other words, being able to be a partner in its publishing and have intention about what I was saying, but not holding on to things that weren't important, but being like, this is actually important about this and I want to find someone who's excited about this part of it. It just really came together in this kind of absolutely gorgeous way, and yet it was still really harrowing, and I had a lot of ambivalence about it, because when you make something and then all of a sudden everyone is going to see it and think about it, even when they say nice things, there's just this sense of kind of existential dread, like what could come, and even like when exciting things are coming, you know, there's a way in which I think you have to buffet yourself, because if you can get so excited about someone saying something nice about your work, well, then how are you going to feel when someone says something not so nice about it? And we're in an age where you get to read everyone's personal opinions on Goodreads and everything else, so you really have to kind of create a kind of armor around yourself and separate yourself from the thing you made. Yeah. And you think, this is a thing I made. This is the best I could do at that moment. This was my intention. And so I really did a lot of work in thinking about that and kind of put it in. Really was excited about it. Got excited through my parents, who are so excited. My parents are like really excited. They like hand sell my book to like every person that they see everywhere.
I love it.
We like got shirts made with the book on it and took pictures. I mean, like I get to feel joy through like that kind of experience, right? I can be like happy for to make my parents proud, even as a grown person, and my teenager who wasn't that excited. But then the novella is getting made into a movie by Netflix, and he was like, "Oh, well, that's kind of cool." So, you know, being able to have joy through other people, and then just kind of separate myself from it, and just think, well, what do I want to make next, and you know, who do I want to be next? It's kind of how I've dealt with it.
There's something I always think about. This is long before I had a book out, but I was reading an Adam Gopnik essay, New Yorker writer who lived in Paris for a while, and he was talking about being in Paris, and he was going to his French shrink, and he had this new book coming out. And he mentions the new book, and the French shrink goes, "Oh, you must start building your battlements." And I'm sure in a lovely French accent that I'm not going to try to imitate, but like, you must start building your battlements. And I was like, "Wow, that's, you know, yeah, like, you have this window. It's done. It's out in the world. And now, how do I differentiate myself so that a criticism of the book isn't a criticism of me?" You know, it's really hard.
It is. And one thing that was helpful is I was a public school teacher for so long. And so I thought, what would I tell my student about this? Like I had to like remind myself of how I would prepare them. And you were constantly preparing them because even though we just did critiques in these little groups, like they were so sensitive. Like they were. They cared how other people saw them. And I just, you know, I had to like counsel myself like, okay, this is what this means. This is your intention. This is what you have control of. And this is what you don't. And, you know, kind of go forward from there.
Yeah. God. So, you know, I assume that, or maybe I shouldn't assume, let me just ask, have you started another project now? Because that is a way, you know, for a lot of us, that's the way that we create distance, is the book goes out in the world, and if anyone has a problem with it, it's like, oh, that was my last book, the new book, it's going to be perfect. Are you working on a new thing at this point?
I am. I did something I said I wasn't going to do, which is I signed a two-book deal.
Oh, boy.
There's something really nice about writing. You think that you don't want to write in obscurity, but there's something like gorgeous about writing in obscurity because no one can tell you what it is, and you're just making up your own idea of your intention, and you can fantasize that everyone will read it or no one will read it. You know what I mean? There's just this freedom in that. And so I knew that when I sold the book and they were like, we want to buy your next book, whatever it is, that was a risk. But also I feel like I can tell myself, I've just learned to tell myself to ignore that, you know? So I am working on something else, and it's been hard because I'm still having so much fun like promoting this book, and I'm here with you all and doing these things, because I'll never have this, you know, first book again, and I want it to find its readers even more. But I do really love, like, I'm in that kind of energetic, like Chicago is, it's not going to be in the book, but it's kind of in the book because I came here. There's this way in which you're collecting everything you do while you're writing a book. I don't know if this is your experience, but everything I do while I'm writing a book kind of finds its way into the book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, if you get into a car accident, all of a sudden you know this feeling of what it feels like to have that experience, and that kind of finds its way into what you're writing, even if it's in a different context. And so I like that energetic feeling of creating things, and it's been nice to be in the world a little bit more instead of just in my house at my desk, which makes it a little harder to have that feeling of transformation, of possibility, of agitation that I think is useful to me when I'm trying to make something new.
It is one of the most interesting things about life as a writer. If things are going well and you're touring, you end up seeing parts of the country or parts of the world that you would never. It's not, and part of it is like, oh, I got to go to some awesome city, but some of it is like, I got brought to Manhattan, Kansas, and I never would have gone there otherwise, but now I know about it. Yeah, just it starts to feed what you do in some way, totally.
Yeah.
So do we have questions to start off with? Usually it just takes one person to ask the first one. Yeah.
Could you talk about your process a little bit from inception through revisions and how much attention you give to the first draft and what you do in the revisions?
That's one thing I love about writing short things, and I think you can do this even if you're writing a bigger thing because it's in pieces. But for me, it's really helpful to be able to write a complete draft of something pretty quickly while the energy of the thing is happening. And so I often write a complete draft. And you know you're supposed to be able to write really bad first drafts, but there's this thing in me that wants the beginning to make sense. Like, it has to be good enough to move forward. The middle can be kind of a mess, and then the end is like, I have to kind of write quickly so that it speaks to the beginning, and then I like revise a lot. Like, I love going back and thinking about it and looking at it. And, you know, I have a writer group that I've had for over 10 years and a newer writer group. So I think there's a lot of possibility in having a community of trusted readers, I think, especially people who you've known, and new readers too. I also, I'm kind of going all over the place, but I also kind of, I don't know if you all remember back in like the 90s and so forth, there was kind of this, a lot of sites, like I think Zoetrope had one where you could just send your work out and people would, strangers would read your things and rate them and give you feedback on them. I used to do that a lot, and then that kind of disappeared. So now I would go on Facebook and just be like, does anyone want to read this? And I have enough people that it might not be someone I know well. And so I've had like kind of strangers give feedback. And what I like about it is you're in charge of your own work, and you don't want to listen to everyone's feedback because that would be terrible. You'd make a really bad story if you try to do everything. But I do like inviting people in because it shows you what you made. The value of having feedback is it shows you what you made, and then you can calibrate what you're making to what you want to make. And sometimes people give you really interesting little insights. And so I do invite a lot of feedback after I have the core of what I want and it sounds pretty good to my ear, and that can be really helpful. But I like to get a draft, kind of a decent draft, together in a relatively short time, which is much harder with a novel, and that's challenging for me.
Yeah. Other questions, please feel free to pop up, and we have a question here. Fantastic.
You were talking about feedback. I was surprised to hear getting feedback off of Facebook, but that was interesting. Could you talk about the editorial process? Did your editor request any changes, that big changes that you didn't want to go along with, or were there any that you did go along with and you thought really made a difference?
That's a great question. So what is it like when you get to that editorial place? So the last two agents, I've had three agents. Agents tend to be really editorial. So even before you get to these days, I think, at least in my experience, even before you send a work out to prospective publishers, you often have gone through a lot of editing. And my agent now is a very editorial. She's a great reader. She gives a lot of feedback. But it's always given, if you have, I think, people who are in partnership with you, as it should be, it's always given you're the ultimate expert on your work. It should be that way. Like, it shouldn't be, you need to do this, and like the person who said, you need to write two novels and then you can put out this short story collection, like, that's not helpful. Like, that person probably wouldn't have been a good editor for me, if that makes sense. It has to be someone who believes in your core vision and then is trying to help you attain it. And I definitely saw my agent and my editors, especially my agent, give suggestions that were really fabulous. Like, she was like, let's change the name from Virginia's Not Your Home to My Monticello, which I think was a brilliant, really smart suggestion. But she also gave some where I was like, well, actually, this is why this was my intention with this. And then maybe she would say, oh, well, then maybe you want to do this too, right? So that's like the kind of partner that you have with that kind of thing. So yes, I definitely got good editorial suggestions, help, you know, kind of fine-tuning. But with the bigger pieces, a lot of that came even before I was giving it to my agent. So that came more from my writing group or from myself looking at it. You know, the time is a great tool when you're editing. You go back and look at your own thing and you can see it new. You have to see it as a new thing, and you're in conversation with even what you made. You're a different person from when you made it, right?
Yeah. And anyone, please come on up.
Can you talk about your writing group and how you work together? And
so that question was just about writing groups. So I've been in several writing groups. I think the biggest thing is creating a sense of trust and community, and people who are going to give you feedback, they're going to, you know, I think there's been this critique of MFAs recently, of writer programs, of trying to make writers into a fit the mold of a standard. And I think that can be really helpful. That can be a source of agitation that's helpful, right? It helps you to like reach that standard. But I think there's this movement, and I think in my writer groups, where you say, what are you trying to do? If you're trying to do this, this seems to be working. If you're trying to do, there's a way in which the writer is invited in as one of the partners to create what the standard is. And I think that's been really helpful. And I think if you have a trusted writer group, they're going to help you to, they're going to allow you to define too what you want. And they may even throw something out there that you didn't know you wanted, right? So you want to be, it's kind of like you want to be between closed and open, right? There's a way in which you're protective of your own vision, and there's a way in which you are open to blowing up that vision into something else. And so I think having that trust and communication. I also think it's really important for people to tell you what's working in pieces. Like, I'm a public school art teacher, so I was always like, let's read all the lines we love in this. Because I think sometimes you forget, if you don't know what's working in your piece, where the core of your voice is, you're not going to preserve that. And you're just going to be chasing all the problems, and that's probably not the best place to write from.
Look forward to reading it, but haven't read it. So I want to know, at the end of reading it, how might I feel? And what attracted to me is I went to Monticello for the first time right after they showed the Sally Hemings secret room and did all that fanfare. Just how should I feel, or how do you feel after reading it all?
Yeah. How do we think she'll feel
after
at the end of the book, or at the end of the novella? That's a really good question.
I.e. hopeful, excited, or
I love that question.
I will just say that my family calls me Debbie Downer. They're like, oh, Mom, not climate change again, please, or whatever, right? So I really feel strongly about the ending of the novella, and I think if you read it the way I hope you do, you're going to feel a combination of hope, like the energy of possibility, but also the weight of what has been brought to bear and what's at stake and what's under threat. In a combination, like, that's what I love literary kind of projects, because it's not going to be one thing. It's not going to be the end of the Avenger movies where everything is okay. You know, it's not going to be like the 80s movies where they're like, yeah, you know, like, it's just, it wouldn't be one thing, right? I want it to be a mix of things, because I think that's how life is in real life, and that's how we feel about things. And so one thing I will say is that the Monticello, like, after the book was going to be published, I wrote them a letter and was like, this book is coming out. It's called My Monticello, you know, and I was kind of thinking, you know, how they could be partners with it. And, you know, it was like crickets for a long time, and they hadn't read the book. And they finally got the book. They read the galley. They had me do an event there. They sell the book in the gift shop.
That's so cool.
And when I go up there, like, a lot of the people who have worked there have read the book. They've given out it as gifts. And so there's something that makes me really happy, right? So if we do have apocalypse and a group of mostly black people have to take refuge there, they can read the manual of what to do and not to do.
I love it. Come on up.
I haven't had a chance to read your book yet. I greatly look forward to it. But in this era when we have more multicultural writing, we also have more censorship, it seems like, and more reluctance in some sectors to tell the truth about history. And I wonder if that weighs on your mind as you're writing about historical places.
Yeah, how does this, like, anti-CRT moment play? There's a way in which it feels like a sham to me. I think it's, like, paraded up to kind of distract people and to create. I don't think it's as organic as it feels. I don't think it's really just a parent somewhere woke up and said, I can't believe what's in the library. I think there's a way it's orchestrated and it gets funded. And yes, people end up feeling that, but it's like that wielding of righteous rage is being stoked in people to a very specific political end. And unfortunately, it can work really well. And then we see it on the news and it becomes this idea that everyone on that side really feels that way. And then it becomes that we do feel that way, right? It's like what you pretend to be becomes what you are. I certainly worry about it for students and for people who literally need access. Sometimes I think about how absolutely insane it is to think this story can't exist for someone to even have contact with. Like, what does that actually mean? Do you know, a story about, whether it be about a queer body or someone being in love with someone of the same gender, or a story about what America might be, even if you disagree with that story, is it so obscene that no one should have access to even imagine it? I mean, that's a very specific kind of point of view that I take huge exception to. Even where it's things I feel strongly about that are harmful. I think there's a way in which we should engage with things that are difficult, that are problematic, that are complicated. I don't think there's one answer. I think that literature puts us in spaces where if something is troublesome, I'd want to go talk about it. Like when I think about how I raised my child, it's like, well, let's go look at that more. Let's look at that and this. Let's look at that, this and this. What does that mean? Is there something in there that's gorgeous that you love alongside something that you don't? I mean, I just think it's just, that's how I feel about it.
I'll just add quickly that, you know, it's so funny because they're happening in such different spaces. The censorship is, you know, about schools in many cases, at least in the U.S., whereas the publishing world and the reading world, we've never been able to talk about more. There have never been more voices. It's all this glorious stuff happening. So, you know, that benefits us all. But, yeah, they're on different planets, these two different things.
And oddly, it drives the interest in a book title.
Of
like,
course.
Censored, maybe I'll, like, this will happen, you know.
Right, anyway, right.
It's just a strange thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. So, I guess this question is for both of you. You have both talked about being teachers, you know, in an earlier part of your careers. So I'm 27, and I've worked for the past few years as a freelance journalist, part-time writing teacher, kind of cobbling things together. And I guess I was wondering if you could both maybe think back to an earlier time in your life where you felt like both really grateful for what you had, but also kind of like far away from your dream of publishing a book, and just kind of think about.
You mean the 20s?
Yes,
your 20s.
How you felt about that?
That's a perfect question to end on, I think, because this is right about the time. So that's a perfect question. I definitely, God, there was a moment. I would have been 28. I remember it was New Year's Eve, and I was thinking back on the previous year, and I was like, nothing good happened this year. Meaning me, selfishly, but it was all about me. But you know, I was teaching, and that was great. I was, you know, trying to have a baby, that wasn't working. I'd published a couple of stories, but then I wasn't getting a lot of writing done. I hadn't published anything that year. I didn't have, like, I had this book that I'd kind of abandoned. I started another book, well, you know, didn't like it. And I was like, this just, you know, nothing, it's not happening for me. It's not happening. And then within the next 2 years, I had a baby. My third published story was chosen for Best American Short Stories. I finished this novel. I got an agent. It was like, you know, just this moment. And I can look back and be like, wah, wah, like, you know, get over it. But it did, it was so frustrating because I think you have in your 20s all this ambition and you're not quite there yet. Whereas when I turned 30, the thing that someone said to me that made me really happy was that, and I think this was true looking back, your 30s are the decade when your ambition best meets your ability. Like you're still really raging for what you want, but you have the ability to get it. It doesn't mean everything's going to happen in your 30s. And your book came out when you were 50, is, you know. So, but it's, yeah, your 20s are just hard, man.
Again, I just think of being an elementary school teacher and just telling kids, I'm like, you're the project, right? You're making something, but the art is going to change you and develop you into the person you want to be. And I think for me, because I was working so long at being an author or just being a good writer, right? So there was like a process to think of myself as an author, but I wanted to make something that was better than I was capable of making, right? So just kind of, I could see the edge of like what I could do and I wanted to try to make something better than myself. And I think it could have been that I wrote the same exact book and no one published it very easily. Like, someone asked me at one point in an interview, like, where have you been all this time? Like, why didn't you publish in your 30s? And I was like, I've been doing the exact same thing. Where have you been? Right? So I think there's a way you can create. And I think part of what allowed me to do that is I had these writing communities that were excited about what I was doing. Or I'd get a story, you know, I had stories that were published in much smaller venues. And then a story that was in Best American, which is the first story in this collection, which is my dad's favorite story, and which I think is probably
it's
one of the best things I've ever written.
Perfect story.
But you just have to find a sense of purpose that isn't about the external, because you can't always control the external. And when you do get those things, you're still going to feel really weird. You're still going to be yourself, like as we were saying earlier. So if you can like find like this inner sense of transformation of I'm trying to figure out, or I want to share this idea, if you can find other ways to calibrate your success and your sense of audience, and know that audience can be that writing group, or it can be the editor that loved your piece. It doesn't have to be someone at the New York Times writing a review of it. Then you're probably going to be happier, and you're probably going to have the be able to sustain yourself long enough to find a bigger audience and to find the kind of writer you want to be and the thing you want to make.
Huge thanks to Jocelyn Johnson. Give a big hand.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, award-winning author Elizabeth Nunez discusses her novel, Now Lily Knows, with Booklist editor Donna Seaman, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.